It's been 22 years since the Good Friday Agreement formally brought an end to the Troubles. My next guest has studied that three-decade conflict through the prism of British intelligence activities against the IRA. I'm joined by Dr. Thomas Leahy, Senior Lecturer in British and Irish Politics at Cardiff University and author of the book The Intelligence War Against the IRA, which evaluates what role British intelligence played in finally producing peace. Thomas, you're very welcome indeed to The History Show.
Many thanks.
When the Troubles began in the late 1960s, did the British have much of an information or intelligence gathering capacity in place, or did they have to build a network from scratch?
So, yes, the intelligence capacity and the opportunity to try and build that capacity began straight away. But because the Provisional IRA, as it was known, was a new organisation with a lot of young members, with no family background in republicanism, it did take time to build intelligence, you know, in terms of who were the key players. And I think evidence suggests there was a lack of information at the start of the campaign on the IRA. For instance, we can see this with internment without trial in August 1971. You know, a lot of people were arrested from the nationalist community initially who were not associated with republicanism at all. And actually, various key IRA members were not arrested initially either. It was hard to build that intelligence initially when, for instance, the Bogside area of Derry City was barricaded and known as Free Derry. So therefore, you know, gathering intelligence in these areas was very difficult and allowed the IRA to operate with some relative freedom in cities initially. Perhaps the key reason, though, is that the Provisional IRA, as mentioned, was a new organisation. So a lot of members joined because of anger about the civil rights movement's treatment, the Royal Ulster Constabulary and the British Army actions in localities and for other reasons. So therefore, there was not already intelligence on some of the key figures that emerged.
Now, I presume capacity was built, an apparatus of some kind was built using agents and informers. So just if you would tell me, what is the difference between an agent and an informer?
So essentially, there's three distinct categories of the types of people passing intelligence on the IRA. So first, there's informers, and informers were IRA members who provided information to Royal Ulster Constabulary Special Branch or various branches of British intelligence that operated in Northern Ireland. Second, there's agents, and agents were not previous members of paramilitary groups like the IRA, but they would, for various reasons though, agree to infiltrate the IRA in order to pass information to the intelligence services. And then you have this third category, which we can term as British Army agents. So this type of agent is a member of the British Armed Forces who infiltrates the IRA for the intelligence services. Now, when this occurred, it tended to be persons from Northern Ireland in the British Army for the obvious reason that someone from England, Scotland, or say Wales, suddenly wishing to join the IRA with a British Army background was going to look pretty suspicious to the IRA in the first place. So yeah, there was a distinction between informers and agents during the conflict.
Why did people become informers, or even why did people become from Northern Ireland itself, infiltrate themselves into the IRA and become agents?
So there's a variety of reasons why one person would inform. And what's interesting is these motives for informing could change even for a single person over time as well. So one useful summary of motives is actually given in some work by Stan A. Taylor and Daniel Snow in a term they used called MICE. And that relates to common motives they discovered for why some Americans informed for the Soviet Union in the Cold War. And what this MICE acronym stands for is money, ideology, compromise or coercion, and ego. And they've added to that excitement and revenge as two other factors. Now, we find similar factors help to account for why some people informed on the IRA. So let's take the case of Raymond Gilmore, a former RUC Special Branch agent who informed on the IRA in the early 1980s. Now, in Raymond Gilmore's memoirs and those of one of his former handlers, they say that Gilmore initially informed partly to avoid a prison sentence for low-level criminality. But they also claim anger for Gilmore of what he saw as IRA social control measures. Also, he had, he says, a desire to save lives and also financial reasons motivating him as well. So the motivations for informing are many, and they could alter over time for a person as well. The trouble is, we cannot get inside someone's head here and verify these motives. So it's difficult then to say that there's a dominant motive or factor in most cases.
Now, I think the IRA at the beginning of the Troubles were still organised in the kind of structures that had obtained in the 1920s. I mean, during the War of Independence, brigades, battalions, companies, all this sort of grandiose military terminology. That changes, though, in the 1970s, and they revert far more to even further back in the mists of Irish history, and that's the cell structure of the Fenian Brotherhood or the Irish Republican Brotherhood. Tell me how that worked and how that impinged on the work of British intelligence.
Sure. So by 1975, the IRA introduced a smaller organisation in Belfast and Derry cities, as the leadership's new aim was persistence, not escalation by that point, and also to prevent informers setting up mass arrests. So in 1977, the IRA publicly announces it would fight what it called a long war, which was until British forces grew weary and decided to withdraw. But it's interesting with this because growing evidence suggests the IRA leadership saw the long war in another way. And the evidence for this comes from senior Republicans, journalists, the late Father Alec Reed, and others. So certainly by the 1980s, the long war seemed to actually be about forcing the British government to return to negotiations. And the failed 1972 and 1975 ceasefire talks between the IRA and British state had seemed to convince Republican leaders, at least, the British would not suddenly withdraw. So instead, IRA leaders felt persistent IRA activity, and by the 1980s, a sizeable Sinn Féin electoral mandate could pressurise the British government and other parties to return to talks. So IRA leaders would seek as much concessions as possible in talks. Now, this focus on persistence partly explains the new cell structure in Belfast and Derry cities from 1975. So the Belfast IRA, as an example, before this point used to operate on a brigade, battalion and company structure, similar to previous versions of the IRA in Irish history. Now, various people on the same street, for example, in Belfast, would therefore be in the same IRA unit. But what that meant was one informer could just set up mass arrests. And this was experienced by the Belfast IRA in 1973, for example. So the cells meant that the Belfast and Derry City IRA reduced its numbers. They would consist typically of 4 to 6 volunteers, and they would mix volunteers from across different parts of the cities to try and confuse British intelligence. And these small cells meant if someone informed, the damage, in theory, would be restricted to one cell, one unit. Now, the important caveat here is the small, tight-knit nature of rural Republican areas and Republican communities, such as in South Armagh, meant that the cell structure was never introduced there because it wasn't needed.
Now, the contention of your book, I think, is that despite the revelations of many IRA informers, political factors actually played a greater role in producing peace than any kind of victory, perhaps, in the intelligence war by the British.
That's right. So, and I think the key thing here is there certainly were British intelligence successes against the IRA in specific time periods in certain regions. But there were certainly intelligence gaps too. Current evidence seems to suggest that British intelligence did not force the IRA into peace to any significant extent. And there's 3 reasons I give for this argument. So first, the Belfast and Derry City IRA cell structure did enable the IRA to persist. So despite agents such as State Knife and other informers that have come to light, the Belfast IRA still carried out various high-profile city centre bombings in the 1990s, in the early 90s in particular. So the Belfast IRA maintained a heightened security environment there by the 1994 ceasefire. The second reason is that the elusive and tight-knit nature of rural IRA units enabled the rural IRA to persist. So yes, the East Tyrone IRA certainly faced setbacks at the hands of the SAS from the late 1980s into the early 1990s. But the South Armagh IRA, the North and Mid Armagh IRA, IRA units in Fermanagh, they did persist to varying degrees by the 1994 ceasefire of the IRA for various reasons. So British forces and Republican sources interestingly agree that rural IRA units were no sideshow, and they actually enabled the IRA to persist and spread its campaign. And the third reason is that the IRA's very highest levels, so its army council, the 7 people, did not appear to be significantly infiltrated. And they would have selected volunteers for operations in England and to bring in weapons shipments, as an example. So this is one way we can test this argument. And there were successes at times against them. So the largest weapons shipments from Libya was captured in 1987, for example. But other large Libyan weapons shipments got through, and that enabled the IRA to persist. And in England, the IRA carried out various high-profile attacks, and that includes the Brighton bombing of the Conservative Party conference in 1984, and various attacks that we all know about in London in the 1990s. And the IRA's Army Council had a long-term leadership of committed Republicans, and that made them difficult to infiltrate. So on a day-to-day level, yes, British intelligence had some successes against specific IRA units in specific time periods, but the evidence suggests that they were not forced into peace by intelligence.
Now, this is a murky world we're talking about here. It's a world of bluff and double bluff. It's a world of deception. Did British intelligence, is there any evidence to suggest that British intelligence ever managed to con the IRA into executing somebody as an informer who was actually not an informer, who was a, if you can, I can use the phrase, a legitimate member of the Irish Republican Army?
Sure. So there's certainly examples and evidence where there's suspicions this might be the case. Always the caveat with this, which makes it difficult to discern this, is that British intelligence has a policy of neither confirming nor denying whether an alleged person was an agent and informer, which from their perspective partly makes sense because they have to protect people who were informers and agents, haven't been revealed. And also you could see that, you know, future agents and informers in today's world are going to be put off if identities are suddenly revealed 10, 20 years down the line. So it's always difficult to know. But, you know, there certainly seems to have been cases which we can partly see because the IRA on a few occasions has apologised for killing suspected people as agents or informers and then said, you know, in hindsight, they've looked back and said that's not the case. So this seems to have been the case. In terms of that being at senior levels, from what we know, doesn't necessarily seem to have actually been the case. But yeah, sure, there were certainly examples from what we know where that occasionally was happening to people.
And were many operations allowed to go ahead, IRA operations allowed to go ahead by British intelligence, because to have prevented these operations from continuing would have jeopardised a spy within the ranks, an agent or an informer?
I think this is a really interesting question. I think from the existing evidence that it's possible, certainly, that smaller level attacks might have gone ahead. So what I mean by that is potentially maybe some IRA public displays, such as checkpoints, manning, that they may have allowed that to happen. They may have allowed, you know, maybe some low-level robberies by the IRA for the movement. But in terms of major events, so for example here, if we look at the debates about whether the senior ranks of the IRA were permanently infiltrated, such as the IRA leadership, there doesn't seem to be the categorical evidence suggests that's the case. And if we look at, yes, there are some attacks, for example, in high-profile attacks in England, which has stopped. So we know is one example that Sean O'Callaghan, so a self-confessed Gardaí and British intelligence informer against the IRA, was stopping some operations in England in the early 1980s. But when we, you know, as two standout examples, the 1984 Brighton bombing, which nearly killed Margaret Thatcher and did kill others, and the 1991 attack on Downing Street by the IRA, you know, these are things that senior informers or agents would have had to stop, and British intelligence said they could have done so. And that's alongside the catalogue of attacks in London and also Manchester as standout examples in the 1990s that led to major economic costs, but also loss of life as well. So I think, yes, possibly at a lower level, it's possible that some IRA disruptions to local areas might have been allowed. But certainly in terms of the major standout attacks, that would have made no sense to the intelligence services at all, because it was actually allowing the IRA's campaign to persist and gain more publicity.
Probably the most high-profile spy, British spy, British intelligence agent in the IRA was known by the codename Steak Knife. Mm-hmm. Was he a kind of a Kim Philby? What impact did he have on IRA operations?
So I think with the Steak Knife case, we certainly seem to know that some kind of agent Steak Knife existed, because various Republicans, be they pro-peace process Republicans or dissenting Republicans, would accept this. And that's the case also with various British security and intelligence officials as well. the identity is disputed, and the person obviously who's been accused of this denies all allegations. But it seems from the evidence we can piece together that this person operated in what's called the IRA's internal security units, certainly from the late 70s, but definitely into the 1980s period. The debate, again, is about the remit of this unit. So from the evidence I could piece together, it seems certainly they had an impact on the IRA in Belfast in specific periods, particularly the kind of mid to late 80s period, where they'd be able to vet certain cells and volunteers as part of a vetting process for the organisation and also to root out informers. What seems, if we even just look at Belfast as one example, so yes, they seem to have some impact. Certainly there's various security forces in their memoirs or in interviews, or also Republicans who suggest that, you know, maybe up to 8 out of 10 IRA operations in Belfast by the 1990s are being prevented. But at the same time, you know, there's these high profile city centre bombings in Belfast again between 91 and 93. And in terms of injuries, loss of life, but also substantial economic damage, you know, the evidence suggests there's no way British intelligence would just allow those things to happen if they could stop them. So what that suggests, even related to Belfast, is the agent state knife seems to have some access there to some IRA units, but not complete access in the team's gaps, perhaps because of things such as cell structure. If we then look elsewhere, particularly with the IRA's rural campaign, take the example of South Armagh, where the IRA is carrying out sniper attacks in the 1990s. Still, it's also able to carry out various attacks on security force bases and security forces themselves. And there's been allegations they were supporting IRA operations elsewhere, including high profile attacks in England in the 1990s. With all of those things going on, that also, you know, strongly suggests that the IRA, in terms of state knife, was not able to just access and infiltrate other units. And partly that makes sense because various British intelligence, security, some former agents and informers themselves have even said, you know, it was not the case where someone from Belfast could just walk into South Armagh and ask to vet their volunteers. That just wouldn't happen because partly for security reasons, but also it didn't make any sense because the South Armagh IRA would know their volunteers better and would be able to vet them in a more thorough way than some outsider would have done. So with state knife, some impact in Belfast it seems to be, but you know, in other units that doesn't really seem to be the case.
Using information provided by agents and informers, to what extent were the British security forces capable of capturing arms shipments to the IRA during the Troubles?
Yes, so we can certainly see that there were some arms shipments that were captured. But at the same time, the ones they didn't capture would be significant here too. And that includes the Libyan weapons, for example, in the 1980s that landed before the Exxon was seized, which was the big one in 1987. So in the 1980s, we know that Sean O'Callaghan, for example, a self-confessed informer, helped prevent a shipment from the United States coming in to the IRA. We also know that the Exxon in 1987 was captured off the French coast. What we don't know with the Exxon is whether that was seized by luck, as some interviewees suggested, or informers. Although an interesting point here is one British official has suggested they didn't often get definitive information about large IRA shipments of weapons, but they did with the Exxon. So there seems to be some hint towards that there. But the key point here is that the other Libyan weapons shipments in the 1980s were not apprehended. And this matters because as Sean O'Callaghan and members of the British intelligence reflected themselves, the IRA, with its low intensity campaign, now had more weapons by the late 1980s than it could actually use. So it had the weapons to persist indefinitely. So the security forces did intercept a few shipments, but the ones that got through allowed the IRA to persist.
Finally, the IRA did suffer some serious losses in the 1980s, personnel blows, psychological blows. I'm thinking particularly of Loch Gull and Gibraltar. What part did informers or agents play in the failure of those IRA operations, if any?
It's difficult to say definitively here. I mean, there certainly is some suggestions that there were informers or intelligence sources of some sort at work here. But I think a key thing is the SAS, which was involved in both incidents, Gibraltar and Loch Gull, the SAS rarely just happens to appear by chance against its adversaries. So it's in place often based on reasonably good intelligence. So in relation to Loch Gull or Gibraltar, available evidence seems to suggest the British had intelligence beforehand. So we can just even deduce this by the fact that, take Loch Gall, for example, the SAS seemed to know exactly which police station the IRA would hit. But that does not necessarily mean it was an informer. So by the late 1980s, there's the evolution of listening devices, for example. So it's not out of the question that intelligence could have been gathered from that kind of source as well. But there's a few other factors to consider here as well with these incidents. So various interviewees and memoirs pointed out that many Republicans killed in Gibraltar or at Loch Gall were seasoned Republicans. So some had served prison sentences and or were involved in Sinn Féin. So these individuals were known as such to intelligence services already. For major operations, be it in England or Gibraltar, for example, the tricky thing for the IRA was that they needed expertise. But with expertise comes the problem that the people involved would often be known. So it was a risk by employing people with expertise. But in addition, some Republicans did feel that in the Loch Gall case, for example, prior intelligence beforehand by the IRA should have been stronger to ensure that they'd get away with it. But as we say, it's difficult to know exactly what was happening here. But the key point is informers cannot always explain why there were some successes against the IRA.
Well, thank you very much for casting some light on some of the dark corners of the troubles of that particular conflict. The book is called The Intelligence War Against the IRA. It's published by Cambridge University Press. The author is Dr. Thomas Leahy. Thomas, thank you very much indeed for joining us on The History Show this evening.
Many thanks for having me. Thank you.